Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. Jeremy Hobson has the day off. It's Here and Now. And Columbus Day is a day off for many, but lots going on in Washington. This morning, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt announced the end to an important Obama-era energy regulation.
Tomorrow in Washington, D.C., I'll be signing a proposed rule to withdraw the so-called Clean Power Plan of the past administration and thus begin the effort to withdraw that rule.
And then on Sunday, Vice President Pence attended a football game only to walk out when players took the knee during the national anthem. The White House immigration plan, released last night, demands that Congress fund a border wall and restrict legal immigration in exchange for the continuation of the DACA program, which defers deportation for certain young adults brought to the U.S. illegally as children. And then there was that Twitter feud between the president and longtime Republican Senator Bob Corker. Corker calling the White House an adult daycare center. Yikes. NPR White House reporter Jeff Bennett is here. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, busy weekend, right?
I know. Start with the immigration overhaul. It also includes removing the special treatment of kids crossing the border alone to escape gang violence in Central America. No Democrats are going to approve of this plan, and some say many Republicans, especially those in border states, won't go for the wall. What's going on here?
Well, the White House really put out an aggressive list of demands. Included among the two things that you just mentioned, it would also curb funding for so-called sanctuary cities. And it would also calls for hiring thousands more immigration enforcement officers and attorneys. What it appears to be is that the White House is trying to move their approach toward a broader immigration reform, which, as you know, has repeatedly failed in Congress. And I talked to a couple of immigration advocates, and they make the case that it's intentional that folks like Stephen Miller, the top White House advisor who's known for his nationalist views, his hardline immigration approach, that they're trying to load this DACA deal such that it exists. They're trying to load it up with poison pills to effectively tank the deal and then blame Democrats for it.
Okay, there's that. But he does hold some cards. I mean, the president has the fate of the Dreamers in his hands.
That's right. And Congress has less than 6 months to come up with something, because you remember when President Trump scrapped DACA, he then opened this 6-month window for Congress to step in and to codify it into law. Democrats, though, still have some leverage here, because President Trump is going to need Democrats to vote at the end of the year for the spending negotiation that would keep the government running. So if in order to get those votes, the thinking is that Democrats will then say, well, fine, if you want us to vote for some sort of bill to keep the government running, then you're going to have to attach the DREAM Act to it. So yeah, that's the hope that Democrats have.
Talk about that very public falling out between the Tennessee Senator Bob Corker and President Trump. Trump taking to Twitter yesterday, you know, attacking Corker, saying that Corker had asked for his endorsement in order to run again, and he didn't give it, and that's why he didn't run, or is saying he's not going to run for re-election. To which Corker replied, it's a shame the White House has become an adult daycare center. Someone obviously missed their shift this morning.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, listen to White House advisor Kellyanne Conway's reaction this morning on Fox News.
We've all worked with Senator Corker over the years. We thank him for his service, but I find tweets like this to be incredibly irresponsible. It adds to the insulting that the mainstream media and the president's detractors, it adds to their ability and their cover to speak about a president of the United States, the president of the United States, in ways that no president should be talked about.
Well, of course, Jeff, some would say the president is speaking on Twitter in ways that no president should.
Yeah.
But Ed Corker gave an interview last night in which he seemed to be trying to ask other Republicans to say, look, we have a problem here. Corker even said he's a golf buddy. Corker was one of the president's former allies. What's going on here?
Yeah, and as you point out, I mean, Corker was on the short list at one point to be Secretary of State. He was rumored to be on the short list for vice president. What's happening here is that Bob Corker has announced he's not running for re-election, and he's felt, I think, very liberated since announcing his retirement. And he's taking to task the president. There are a couple things in that New York Times interview that stood out to me. First was that, you know, Trump claims Corker begged him for his endorsement. Corker says that was not the case. And then he said, I don't know why the president tweets out things that are not true. You know he does it. Everyone knows he does it, but he does. And then he also said that his concerns about Trump are shared by nearly every Republican in the Senate. And Corker says, look, except for a few people, the vast majority of our caucus understands what we're dealing with here. The implication being that Corker's saying it out loud because he has nothing to lose. It's really fascinating.
Well, and is it dangerous for the president in that he still needs Republicans to pass legislation?
Yeah, to be sure. Going after Corker makes it harder for Trump to get his way, both on tax cuts and the Iran deal, which all the reporting suggests that President Trump will take steps to decertify the Iran deal and then kick it over to Congress to come up with a solution. And the other thing is that President Trump's previous attempts to pressure senators, whether it be on Twitter or face-to-face, that very rarely has the desired effect.
NPR's White House reporter Jeff Bennett, we have to leave it at that. Jeff, thank you.
You're welcome.
Now to a story about researchers trying to understand how dementia progresses. Alzheimer's is the most common form, but another form, frontotemporal dementia, also with a genetic link, affects about 60,000 people in the U.S., and it can rob them of their minds and personalities well before they reach old age. One man who lives in rural Washington State has the gene linked to this form of dementia, but so far he doesn't have the disease, and researchers are trying to understand why. Janelle Alicia from our partners at Kaiser Health News reports.
John Janda's mother, Lucille, was just 47 when she first started showing signs of frontotemporal dementia. The disease is not as common as Alzheimer's, but it generally strikes much earlier, and people often experience dramatic, even bizarre personality changes decades before they die.
Well, she couldn't focus on an issue, but she could remember little things, and she could remember things like old songs, things like that, and she could remember some people. It got worse as it got older. It got worse.
By the time Janda's mother died at 93, she could no longer recognize him unless he sang one of her favorite songs.
I'd sing her a little bit of what they call Hello, Dolly. Hello, Dolly, meet the band, Dolly. And she would say that. It's so nice to have you back where you belong. It makes me cry. But every time I do that, it makes me cry. I think I got that from her.
Many of Janda's aunts and uncles also suffered from frontotemporal dementia. And in 2009, after a health scare, he decided to be tested for the genetic mutation that can cause the disease. The result was positive, which meant John Janda would almost certainly suffer his mother's fate.
You have to look at what happened with people in your own family and what could possibly happen to you. So it is kind of an unnerving thing.
But something surprising has happened. At 68, John Janda is more than two decades older than his mom was when she got sick. And the contractor who builds custom homes is still fine. Tom Bird is his doctor.
He returned to work. He's still building houses. He's still an accomplished professional craftsman. He lives independently with his wife at home. He's going to be 69 years old this summer, and he's doing great.
On a recent afternoon, Bird met Janda at a relative's home. On the kitchen table is a diagram of Janda's family tree. Bird points to the top of the chart.
This is your family tree. And that's your mother.
Okay.
And there's you, John, and all your brothers and sisters. There are people in this generation of the family who have developed the disease.
Along with being Janda's physician, Bird is also a professor of neurology and medical genetics at the University of Washington in Seattle. Bird, along with his team, was among the first to discover the mutation that causes frontotemporal dementia. He's been studying Janda's family since the late 1980s. He's found four generations of that family that have been stricken with frontotemporal dementia. John Janda is among a rare group of people who, Bird says, appear to be protected from the disease.
We know they have the mutation, but for some reason, they live to a normal elderly age, die of something else, and never show signs of the disease. And we would love to know why. What a terrific clue that would be to a treatment for the disease and help them.
Bird says he and other researchers are collecting DNA from several families. Bird would like to test Janda's 7 brothers and sisters for the mutation, but so far, they don't want to be burdened with the information. Because nothing can be done, there's no treatment, and no cure for the disease. But John Janda says he wants to help solve the mystery.
One of the things that keeps me going the most is being able to help other people. I didn't think that I was even going to be alive.
In the months to come, more of Janda's DNA will be analyzed in hopes it will provide some answers to why he has so far escaped the disease that took the mind of his mother and so many of his other relatives. For Here and Now, I'm Janelle Alicia in Seattle.
To Afghanistan now. The NATO combat mission there, joined by the U.S., ended in 2014. Afghanistan's military then took the lead role in the battle against the Taliban. Now the 11,000 U.S. troops, with 3,000 more on the way, are there as trainers, though still in harm's way. The U.S. military reports the Taliban and other militant groups now control more than a third of the country, and President Trump acknowledged that in August when he outlined the new strategy to deploy 3,000 more troops with no timetable for their mission. So what's the view from inside Afghanistan? The BBC's Justin Rowlatt sat down for a lengthy interview with President Ashraf Ghani in Kabul recently. He's back now in Delhi, India. Justin, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you very much indeed, Robin. Good to be back.
Yeah, and here's President Ghani with his assessment of the fight against the Taliban as he spoke with you. Let's listen.
Is it difficult? Yes, but it's no longer impossible. In 2014, when I became president, it looked like an impossible task. Now it looks like a difficult task, and difficult is within our grasp.
So, Justin, is he fooling himself? I mean, there are estimates that Afghanistan has lost about 10% of its fighting force. 7,000 killed, 12,000 injured, thousands more deserting. Do you think his assessment is correct?
Well, I put exactly those statistics to him, and I said to him, so are you telling me you've turned the corner? And he said without hesitation, yes, he believed that Afghanistan had. So I think what he's saying is that with the support of America, thanks to the commitment that Donald Trump made to increase troop numbers and also to stay for an indefinite period, stay as long as it takes to break the stalemate in Afghanistan, he thinks with that support behind him, the Afghan forces will gain the strength they need, if you like, to take the battle to the Taliban and begin to change the realities on the ground. And yes, you're absolutely right. I think many military analysts would say that's optimistic. I think he feels that the Afghan military really has gone through a sea change in the last 3 years. He said when we took over the battle at the end of 2014, we were like 12-year-olds. He said now we've grown, they're now more like 30-year-olds. So he clearly thinks there's been a process of maturing and a growing capability within Afghan forces.
Well, and he says that he believes that at the end of 4 years, the NATO and U.S. forces can pull out. What's the thinking there? As you said, President Trump has committed more troops, but no timetable.
Well, the idea of no timetable was in a way to address what many military analysts thought was the flaws of Obama's former policy. So Obama, you probably remember, authorized this huge surge, a great increase in the number of troops in Afghanistan, but he also gave a date for withdrawal. And it was felt that the Taliban at that point said, well, if that's the case, we'll sit back and we'll wait until you leave. And at that point, we'll fight the real war, which is the war for the control of Afghanistan, the war against the AI. ANA, the Afghan National Army. So there was a feeling in a way that that backfired a bit. The troops went in. It looked as if they'd pacified the country. But in fact, the Taliban was sitting back waiting for the real battle, if you like, to begin. And what Ashraf Ghani says is, he says, look, you know, there were 110,000 coalition troops, NATO troops, led, of course, by America. When they pulled out, a huge number of troops, they were suffering significant casualties. He says, look how successful we've been. He said the Taliban's agenda was to take over Afghanistan, or at least take control of whole provinces. He says they failed miserably by those ambitions. He says neither ambition has been achieved. So he would say, look, you know, we took on a really, really difficult fight. And actually, despite the statistics that we discussed at the beginning, we're doing rather well. In fact, he believes, I think, that they're going to get better and better at fighting the war. So much so, as we said, that he may well not need the support of NATO forces.
Well, but isn't it true that there have been significant Taliban gains in Helmand and other provinces, and the Taliban has taken over government roles, health and education?
It's true that the Taliban claims to provide those services in some areas. I said to Ashraf Ghani, I said, you know, Helmand, you know, it's almost the entire province, a province which both Britain and America fought very, very hard to defend, is now almost completely in Taliban control. And he had a very interesting take on that. He said, listen, he says he doesn't believe the Taliban have huge support in Helmand. So why is the Taliban doing so well? He says, because of heroin, because the Taliban grow opium poppies, and because they are, he says, with justice, the biggest suppliers of heroin in the world. He says that drug money is what fuels the insurgency, what funds the war. So he sees this as a drug war. And in fact, he was quite explicit, saying, you know, one of his agendas is to talk to Western countries, the consumers of heroin, talk to them about controlling the demand for heroin in their countries, looking at ways to regulate the supply of heroin. Because he says without the heroin, there simply wouldn't be an insurgency. The Taliban wouldn't be able to afford to wage the kind of war that it's fighting at the moment.
Look, you're relaying to us what the Afghan president said to you. What did you observe? I mean, we know you had to hit the deck when the Taliban struck the Kabul airport with mortar bombs. So you certainly observed that. But did you think the Afghan president looked as strong as his words? And what about the rest of the country, schools, roads? Does it feel as if the country's being rebuilding?
Look, I'll be absolutely honest. It doesn't feel as if the country is rebuilding. You know, the country faces enormous challenges, economic challenges. I mean, the war now has gone on for almost 16 years, this war. And remember, of course, there were wars before that. There was a civil war. There was the war with the Russians. So Afghanistan has been at war now. If you look back over decades, obviously that's really affected the economy. The economy is in a very bad state. And without the support of other countries, you know, Afghanistan would not be able to survive and certainly wouldn't be able to fight the war in the way it is at the moment. So it faces huge challenges. It's also terribly corrupt. And this is another thing that Ashraf Ghani says he wants to do. He says he's determined to root out corruption, even if it costs, he says, his presidency. So there are no question, there are huge, huge challenges for the Afghan president. He said to me that as far as he was concerned, he had the worst job in the world. And I would have thought it certainly is a contender for that title. But, you know, I mean, what you felt was a sense of optimism, that he feels that 3 years into his presidency, he feels as if this is a time where he can begin to come out. And I suppose what he's doing, talking to me in this very frank way, is saying to the world, look, I believe there's been a change in my country. You know, that's the message that he wanted to get out. I believe there has been a change. He says, you know, he's very thankful to Donald Trump for the support that America has given his country. And in a way, what he wants to say is, listen, here's the repayment. We're really going to double down on corruption, and we're really going to make an effort to be able to take responsibility for this battle against the Taliban ourselves. And I think that's the clear message that he wanted to make in our interview.
Justin Rowlatt, reporting for the BBC, and speaking about his interview with the president of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani. Justin, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
Well, back in the U.S., you might have noticed extra security for outdoor events over the weekend after Las Vegas. I saw garbage trucks blocking streets for an Oktoberfest. Yesterday, Chicago Marathon saw heavily armed police officers walking the streets. But the race went off without a hitch, and it turned out to be a great day for American distance running. Here now is Alex Ashlock, has this report on the Chicago Marathon results.
USA! Galen Rupp made history when he crossed the finish line first in the men's elite race in Chicago yesterday. He's the first U.S. runner to win the race in 15 years. But more than that, Galen Rupp is now clearly America's best marathoner. He won a bronze medal in the 2016 Rio Olympics. He finished second in this year's Boston Marathon, and now he's added this historic victory in Chicago. At the finish line yesterday, Rupp was greeted by his twins, Emmy and Grayson, and his wife, Kira.
When I saw my family, my wife and my kids, they give so much for me to be able to do what I love. My wife is literally, she's given up her life to support me, and it's a real emotional thing. You know, you put so much into this one race, and to see them at the finish line, to see them happy, you know, it means the world to me.
Rupp won the men's race by nearly 30 seconds, but the winner in the women's marathon in Chicago was even more dominating. Tirunesh Dibaba of Ethiopia finished almost 2 minutes ahead of the second-place finisher. But 26-year-old American Jordan Hasse made a serious statement with her third-place finish. Running only her second marathon ever, Hasse recorded the fastest time ever by a U.S. woman in Chicago, 2 hours, 20 minutes, and 57 seconds. Joan Samuelson, winner of the first women's Olympic marathon way back in 1984, set the old course record in Chicago in 1985, before Hasse was even born.
I'm just so thankful for Joni. We have a very special relationship, and there's a big photo of me up at the Nike store downtown. It says one of my goals, which is to win an Olympic gold medal in the marathon, and she's holding a sign that says, "You will." And so I was thinking of that photo the last half. It's an honor to follow in her footsteps.
Familiar faces claim the men's and women's wheelchair races in Chicago. Switzerland's Marcel Hug won for the second straight year, and American Tatiana McFadden capped a comeback from health issues to win for the 7th consecutive year. She had surgery earlier this year for blood clots, and after the race, she spoke to NBC in Chicago.
I feel amazing. It was really hard to come back since February with the clots, and you know, I didn't think I was going to be able to come back marathoning this year, but crossing that finish line was pretty emotional and exciting, and couldn't ask for a better day and better weather. Well, you had a
lot of people. McFadden hopes to compete in the world's next big marathon in New York City on November 5th. That race will also mark the end of Meb Keflezighi's storied marathon career. The 42-year-old will run his 26th and final competitive marathon where it all started. Keflezighi ran his first ever marathon in New York City in 2002. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
Here in Boston, fans expect a lot from their teams and a lot from the reporters who cover them. I'm Boston Globe sports columnist Chris Gasper. I'm working with WBUR to bring you a new daily podcast, Season Ticket. I'll take fans with me for a behind-the-scenes look from the press box to the locker room and beyond. Season Ticket, available at wbur.org/seasonticket or wherever you get your podcasts. Funding provided by Zip, the smartest way to hire.
The future of the world's most important central bank is becoming less certain. A third seat on the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors goes vacant end of this week when Stanley Fischer steps down. The Trump administration hasn't nominated any candidates for those positions, and speculation is it's because he's weighing whether to keep Janet Yellen on as chair. Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst and host of Jill on Money for CBS News. Her podcast is Better Off. Jill, happy Columbus Day.
Happy Columbus Day. Markets are still open, so it doesn't feel like a holiday.
No, not for you. Well, not for many of us. So this, the Senate confirmed Randall Quarles to the Fed's Board of Governors last week. He's a former Undersecretary of the Treasury under President George W. Bush, a partner at the Carlyle Group, one of the world's most successful investment firms. He's going to oversee banking rules. Now, because of his background, is there an expectation he will loosen regulations, which some people feel weren't tightened enough after the financial collapse?
Absolutely. Randy Quarles is a lawyer trained at Davis Polk, so a lot of folks know him in the industry. Worked a lot with financial veterans before joining that Treasury Department back in 2002. And he was absolutely brought in to make the rules a little bit easier. So he succeeds a guy named Dan Tarullo. He stepped down from the Fed earlier this year. Tarullo was the Fed's point person on regulation. He was never confirmed as vice chairman, but that was a a post that was supposed to have direct regulatory impact over systemically important financial institutions, or SIFIs. Mm-hmm. And what we know about Quarles is that he basically thinks that we need to relax some of the rules that have been imposed on the financial industry since the Dodd-Frank reform.
Yeah. Well, what about Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen? Trump slammed her on the campaign trail, but has stepped back from some of that. Her term is up in February. It's expected he'll nominate her replacement soon. What are the politics here? Is it about someone who would raise or lower the interest rates? I mean, what do we know about what President Trump wants?
Well, we don't know much about what he wants around monetary policy, because when he was a candidate, he, as you said, he criticized Janet Yellen. And I think he voiced a lot of the conservative economist criticism, which is the Fed had been keeping interest rates too low for too long, that it was dangerously close to fostering asset bubbles, meaning stock market highs, which we're seeing, maybe some housing bubbles on the coast. But, you know, the other part of the Fed's main job, in addition to making sure inflation doesn't run too hot and that the job environment is a good one, is regulatory. And I think that the messaging around who would replace these open seats has more to do with the regulatory issues than monetary policy. Because, again, we haven't heard a lot about monetary policy at all. In fact, as a president, President Trump should want Janet Yellen for that exact reason. Those low interest rates help the bull market to continue in the stock market, and that's something he brags about quite often.
Right. Well, you write that over his term, President Trump could nominate up to 5 Fed board members when it comes to retirements. Now there are going to be 3 empty seats when Fisher steps down this week. So what does that matter if there are empty seats?
Before everyone's eyes glaze over, because we're talking about the Federal Reserve, wake up, everyone. You know, the reality is the Federal Reserve is one of those weird parts of the economy that impacts everyone, right? Because we talk about monetary policy, we're talking about interest rates, and interest rates impact people who are borrowing money and save money. And it may impact your small business owner. Maybe you work for a small business, and the ability for a small business to get a loan can be impacted by this. So it really does matter.
Yes.
And I think what's really important here, the regulatory issue is going to become huge. That's where you're going to see the watering down of Dodd-Frank. Just in time for the anniversary.
Just in time for the end of the segment. Jill Schlesinger of CBS News, thank you. You may have seen the videos from New York-based comedian and singer Randy Rainbow. Yes, that's his real name. Millions have watched him on YouTube. He splices himself into real Senate hearings or a 60-minute segment on Hillary Clinton, providing his own interview questions and usually breaking into a popular Broadway tune before it's all over, complete with multi-character costumes. His recent version of How Do You Solve a Problem Like Korea, a Sound of Music parody, lampooned President Trump's tweets about North Korea. Randy starts by inserting himself into an interview with UN Ambassador Nikki Haley before donning a full nun's habit and bursting into song.
'Cause how can you do the trick with childish rhetoric? How can two tiny men have such big heads? How do you solve a problem like Korea?
And that parody soon morphs into Elton John's Rocket Man, or in this case, Raucous Man. Randy Rainbow joins us from NPR's New York studios. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
How tired are you of
I haven't slept since January, to be honest with you. I'm holding on by a thread, but I'll make it through.
Well, because you're having to respond to so much, I'm imagining. Less than a day after White House Communications Chief Anthony Scaramucci was fired, you came out with your new video, Sycophant Italiano. We cannot play that because there's just a bit too many beeps in that one. But did you feel like, wait a minute?
Well, it was quite crazy the way it happened because I was editing the video. I had a whole sort of different video planned. When the news came through, without thinking, I just did my hair and makeup, and I just jumped in front of my green screen and had to reconstruct the whole ending of the video.
Talk more about what you're talking about. Jumped in front of your green screen. Is this a screen you have at home so that you can stand in front of it and then superimpose video on that screen?
I am. If you saw my setup, you would laugh at me. It's quite absurd. I do it all from my little studio apartment in Astoria, Queens, and I stand in front of a camera on a tripod while my cat watches me making faces at me.
And lately it has been a lot of this administration, but we should point out during the campaign, you went after Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine, her vice presidential nominee, although as you said, Tim, nobody knows who you are. So here you are, Randy Rainbow, in your kind of Anderson Cooper 60 Minutes suit, playing the part of the interviewer. Let's listen.
Hey, thanks so much for sitting down with me during such a busy time. It's really an honor to speak with both of you.
I will be the president.
Whoa, calm the f*** down. Timmy, no one even knows who the hell you are. What is it like for you to be sitting in the company of such a strong and powerful woman? And I don't just mean me. Hillary is here, too.
By the way, Randy, are you openly gay?
No, and how dare you? How presumptuous of you. Is this live? I hope not. Yes, I am very openly gay.
Well, that's an aspect.
Thank you for asking.
Much of the time, you're spoofing a certain kind of Broadway affect, if you will. I mean, you are, you know, openly, flamboyantly, wonderfully, marvelously, you know, being yourself.
Well, thank you. I think kind of what you see in the videos is true to me. It's, if not, maybe a slightly heightened version of my real self.
How did this start? Just the idea of, well, I'm just going to insert myself in interviews, and then suddenly lights will dim and I'm going to jump into costume and sing a Broadway song.
I started by doing a blog back when everyone was blogging, which was kind of just about my life. And that turned into kind of doing more hot topic stuff. And I would tackle, do commentary on what everyone was on everyone's Facebook feed. And I guess from there, I started working for BroadwayWorld.com, which is a very well-known Broadway website. So they had me sort of doing hot topics, but for Broadway. Coming from a musical theater background, I would just tell the news via Broadway show tunes. And that's how the song parodies came about. Somehow along the way, I put the two together and did the more mainstream news with the show tunes. And somehow it kind of works.
Well, let's go back to some of the videos. There's your take on Summer Nights from Greece. It features former FBI Director James Comey and Attorney General Jeff Sessions at their committee hearings on the Russia investigation in mid-June. You are a senator, a lawmaker, questioning them. You've inserted yourself in. Ties. Everybody's wearing different ties in every shot. It's called Russia Ties. Let's listen.
This is what happened.
I'll ask the questions. Thank you.
Did the Russians hack Hillary?
No doubt.
Did the Russians back Mr. T?
I don't recall.
Are we all under attack?
I'm confident.
Why'd you meet with Kislyak?
I don't recall.
Lies and greed, when will they lead to all of his Russia ties?
You play the T-Birds in their leather jackets, the pink ladies with their cardigans and glasses all from Greece, while we keep cutting to the two.
There's no end to my costuming.
No. And again,
got a $10 budget.
Right. I was just going to say, all in your apartment. Has anybody ever said anything about, well, you can't use that video of the hearings, for instance?
No, I have not, knock on wood, heard that yet. I think pretty much everything I do is very clearly under the fair use parody category.
Yeah.
So far I'm in the clear.
Again, you've been bipartisan, although lately not as much. But let's go back to during the campaign when you went after all the candidates. Here's your GOP dropout song. This was for Marco Rubio. What are we seeing here?
I did the whole series every time one of them would drop out. Of the primaries, I would sing them off with the Teen Angel song, Beauty School Dropout, but it was GOP Dropout.
Okay, let's listen.
GOP Dropout, knew your campaign would finally pass. GOP Dropout, you were a campaign in the... Well, your odds were low and they decreased with all that trash you're talking. Now it's time to go, but hey, at least your boots were made for walking.
You lampoon Rubio for the insults he threw out, the size of Donald Trump's hands.
I'm still using that one.
Are you thinking about this all of the time?
Yeah, I kind of have to. I mean, I have like 700,000 people on Facebook alone. Asking for them on a daily basis. And so I feel an obligation now.
This is your take on Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Russian lobbyist and others. You had to go to Lin-Manuel Miranda's The Room Where It Happened from Hamilton.
Obviously.
Yes. Well, we saw pictures of the Russian lawyer who was in the room and Donald Trump Jr. Let's listen.
Donald claims.
Someone sent me an email.
A publicist named Goldstone, a friend of the family.
Donald claims
that he might have made a boo-boo.
In retrospect, I probably would have done things a little differently.
Donald claims.
Jared Kushner dropped by but got bored pretty quick and then he dipped out quietly.
Donald claims.
So before you change your tune, you're saying there's the lady, Slim Shady and Junior, but someone else was in the room where it happened. The room where it happened. The room where it happened. Lots of Russians in the room where it happened. The room where it happened. The room where it happened.
What are you hearing from people? You've got millions of hits as people watch this on social media. But, you know, this is a pretty tense time, and Donald Trump supporters, you know, are feeling, you know, that he won, and he's their guy, and he hasn't had a chance. Are you hearing from them as well?
I do hear certainly from everybody all across the board. I always say it's surprising, though, how much hate mail I don't get, considering the subject matter I'm tackling. I hear a lot from people saying, you know, I just have to tell you I don't agree with your political views. I don't I have nothing in common with you, but I love your videos. and I always say thank you. That's terrific. Let's grab a drink sometime. You sound great. I think it kind of speaks to just sort of how unifying comedy can be in times like these.
But how would you feel if a satirist was doing the same kinds of things, mocking, you know, President Obama at a lectern, you know, cutting up his interviews or something? How would you feel?
Would I be offended by it, do you mean?
Yeah.
Not I. I mean, I'm from the Joan Rivers, Don Rickles kind of old school comedy in that nothing is off the table, certainly not in politics. So I think if you can find something to laugh at that's got people kind of on edge or you know, stressed out, I think you got to go for it.
Randy Rainbow, comedian, singer, actor, satirist, a YouTube phenomenon now with his Broadway-themed political satire. They star him, we'll link you. Randy, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. I have to say.
Yeah?
Can I say something?
Please.
I just wanted to say that of everything that I've ever done and everything I ever will do, being interviewed on NPR is what is my mother is most excited about. So you've made dreams come true today.
Dark as shame, Donald. Dark as shame.
Glad to be of service, Mom. Well, we have some of his videos at hearandnow.org. You're listening to Here and Now.
Can't you be half as generous as you've been with the KKK and white supremacists?
Richard Thaler, who's been called the father of behavioral economics, was once laughed off a conference stage for suggesting people don't make rational choices when it comes to finances. Well, he's now won the Nobel Prize for Economics for that theory, and he goes further. He says you can predict people's irrational financial choices and create policy to help them make better ones. Richard's work at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business landed him in a film. Here's a clip from The Big Short, which explained how the housing bubble triggered the U.S. financial crisis. Richard has a cameo sitting at a blackjack table next to Selena Gomez, who's got a hand that looks like a sure win.
I'm on a winning streak. Everybody in this place wants to get in on the action. How could I lose, right?
Now, this is a classic error. In basketball, it's called the hot hand fallacy. A player makes a bunch of shots in a row. People are sure they're going to make the next one. People think whatever's happening now is going to continue to happen into the future. During the real estate boom, markets were going up and up, and people thought they would never go down.
Well, but they did. Simple. But how come so few got it? Richard Thaler joins us now. Professor Richard, congratulations.
Thank you. And thank you for starting with the high point of my career.
In fact, we're hearing that you were wondering why the Nobel Committee didn't mention that.
I thought it should have been at the beginning of the citation, but, you know.
Well, how I got it right, you know, your theory, the idea that people are not as rational as most economists always thought they'd be. There was always this sense of, you know, the invisible hand that would guide the market and guide people in their decision making. You say no.
I say no. And, you know, economics used to be that way. If you go back to Adam Smith, he was a behavioral economist. He talked about overconfidence and self-control problems and loss aversion. Economists started clinging to rationality, really, in the 1950s. It started as a convenient way of formalizing economics because rational choices are the easiest ones to model. The problem is that people started taking those models seriously as if they described the world rather than an idealized world.
Yeah. Give us some examples. And you had the 2008 book Nudge with Cass Sunstein. We've spoken about that here as well. This idea that you can see some of these almost default decisions that people make about money. Give us some examples.
Well, probably the most famous is the idea that if you automatically enroll people into 401k plans, then many more join than if you use the traditional strategy of saying they have to fill out some form in order to qualify.
Yeah.
An economic model would say that this doesn't really matter. How long does it take to fill out a form? The retirement plan is worth tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. But we see simply making the default to join has a very powerful effect. Typically, we get over 90% enrollment.
Right. And the thinking was, why wouldn't people rationally enroll in the retirement plan that would be good for them? But they don't. And so switch to the you're automatically enrolled, opt out. In fact, a lot of your thinking has become public policy. Britain started a sort of behavioral economics department after your book Nudge. The U.S. has followed. How has that felt to see some of this become policy?
Well, truthfully, Cass Sunstein and I were shocked at the beginning and continue to be. There are, at last count, at least 75 governments around the world with so-called nudge units. You know, I think it's terrific because it's really just introducing science into government and trying to help people achieve their goals.
Do you think a turning point was the housing crisis? You just heard the scene from The Big Short. You had a shaken Alan Greenspan. I mean, shaken. Kind of saying, I'm paraphrasing, but saying, wow, who would have thought that people would buy mortgages they couldn't afford and banks would sell them to them knowing they couldn't afford it and that the market wouldn't just take care of everything, which we thought it would. Do you think that's when people said, okay, this has gone too far?
Well, I think many financial economists were shaken by the events of October 1987 when there was a single day when the market fell 23%. Then the technology bubble in the late 1990s and the real estate bubble and then the Great Recession. All of these, I think, taught economists that the world was more complicated than they thought and they might need to rethink how they go about their business.
Yeah. Richard Thaler of the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, Nobel laureate in economics, once scoffed at for his thinking that people don't make rational decisions about money, but you can predict their irrationality. Richard, by the way, I know you told the New York Times that you're going to spend the money that comes with the prize irrationally. But do you still find yourself doing things that you have to even second guess yourself and say, wait a second, that's irrational?
Oh, sure, all the time. But then I decide whether I want to be rational or irrational.
Right. Just be mindful.
Right.
Thank you so much and congratulations again.
Okay. Thanks, Robin. Always good to talk to you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.